Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Hello, and welcome to Philosophy for Our Times, bringing you the world's leading thinkers on today's biggest ideas. Most of us want to be good, but we also want to be seen to be good. But aren't those two goals contradictory? Isn't the desire to be seen to be good a means of placing ourselves higher than others, gaining status and position as a result? Should we conclude that the attempt to be seen to be good is immoral and call it out as hypocritical? This would include philanthropist donations, explicit piety on the part of the religious, as well as virtue signaling, be it on campus or on social media. Or is being seen to be good vital to cement socially positive behavior? Is explicit public demonstration of morality the only morality worth having? To discuss this moral gaze of public morality, we invite world-leading cultural theorist Kwame Anthony Appiah, Professor of Sociology and African Studies and International Authority on Race, Crystal Fleming, and founder of Prospect magazine, David Goodhart. If you enjoy today's episode, don't forget to like and subscribe on your platform of choice, and visit ii.tv for hundreds more podcasts, videos, and articles from the world's leading thinkers. I'll hand you over to our host for this debate, Mark Linsmeyer.
Hey folks, let's meet our speakers. David Goodhart is a British journalist and cultural commentator and the founder and former editor of Prospect magazine. Crystal Fleming is a professor of sociology and Africana studies at Stony Brook University, an international authority on race, and author of three books on race, anti-racism, and white supremacy. Kwame Anthony Appiah is a British Ghanaian philosopher who's received numerous awards, including being named a top global thinker by Foreign Policy magazine and receiving the National Humanities Medal at a ceremony at the White House. So we're going to start with a three-minute opening statement from each of those folks in order. So let's start with you, David. Is it wrong to want to be seen to be good?
No, I don't think it is, really. It's kind of how you do it, though, isn't it? People have always signaled virtue, I guess. Perhaps what's different about it now, why it's become kind of almost a political issue. But I think one of the things that's made it different now is that there was more agreement in the past, at least in the kind of dominant or most sort of cohesive culture. There was more of an agreement about what virtue was. We live in more value plural times. 100, 150 years ago, we had religious belief, we had patriotism, we had traditional social roles, all of which gave us a pretty clear collective idea of what virtue was. And of course, we also had less opportunity in the past to signal virtue widely. I mean, we could only signal to people we met, really. And of course, technology and, you know, social media, most famously, you know, Twitter is a great institution for, or at least for some people, for virtue signaling. But and I think certainly in the kind of modern political context, signaling virtue, signaling membership, isn't it? Signaling membership of an identity group or a kind of ideological group or a political group or whatever. I mean, we associate it very much with a kind of activist phenomenon. And I suppose in the language of my last book, The Road to Somewhere, which I do, you know, the talk of people who see the world from anywhere, people who see the world from somewhere. I mean, there is a sort of tendency, I guess, in the kind of anywhere worldview, particularly the more activist end of the anywhere worldview, to see the virtue in liberal openness and autonomy, and to be in favour of social fluidity and so on, and to want to show that one is, it's sort of almost sort of superior to the ordinary run of people because one is, you know, an elevated sort of ascendant liberal. There was also something a bit sort of childish about it, about virtue signaling. You know, children do it, you know, very sort of spontaneously and rather sweetly. You know, look, mummy, you know, I've sort of done this. And I think there's something about the fact that we're becoming, in some ways, a kind of younger culture, in that milestones that people used to achieve in their 20s, they kind of now don't achieve until their late 20s or even their 30s. And that we're becoming a bit more infantile, I think, and perhaps an excess of virtue signaling is part of that.
Crystal Fleming, let's move on to you. Your opening statement, is it wrong to be seen to be good?
It's human. It's a basic sociological, even social psychological process, right? So one of the things about morality is that it is a collective endeavor. Morality has no meaning without socialization, without collective dissemination of ideas, without engaging in community. So wanting to be seen to be good is, and by the way, I don't think everyone wants to be seen to be good. I think there are people who are amoral, but most people want to be seen to be good. And this can both be productive and problematic, right? So not good just for your people or what's good for the dominant groups, but what's good for the maximum, you know, set of communities. So the question of what is good is also very subjective. Hitler probably thought he was good. I think we also have to think about things like virtue signaling beyond the individual level. We have to think about historical, larger historical and cultural examples of virtue signaling. We could think about Western society, to take just one example, but most cultures try to engage in presenting themselves as virtuous. But the virtue signaling of Western culture is something that, for example, would define colonization as good and only good, whereas people who have been victimized by colonization have a very different perspective. So I think one of the most important things is not necessarily to want to be seen as good, but to want to engage in the greater good and support the greater good. And also to be open to acknowledging that neither individuals nor entire societies can be entirely good, right? So having a kind of reflexivity, a kind of awareness of the fact that we are morally complicated beings, both at the individual and collective levels, and therefore no one can be only good. In fact, the desire to be seen as only good is also a huge barrier to acknowledging racism, both at the individual and collective level. So if I'm a good person, many people think, well, of course I can't be racist, which is ridiculous. So, but that desire to present a sense of self that is only viewed as good, again, can be a barrier, right? That kind of egoic need to believe in one's virtue and not acknowledge moral complexity or even try to attain some kind of moral purity. All of that is quite problematic and I think presents barriers to the greater good.
Anthony, your opening statement, is it wrong to want to be seen to be good?
Well, I think it's wrong to want to be seen to be good, A, if you aren't. That's obviously a good example of a case where it's wrong. And B, if you care more about being seen to be good than being good. This is just one of the classic paradoxes about honor, which is something I once wrote a book about. Being honorable is being entitled to respect. And so you want to be entitled to respect. You want to be respected by your social peers. But one of the oldest paradoxes about honor is that if you want to be recognized as worthy, you can end up pursuing a good reputation without actually worrying about whether you deserve it. And the key thing about honor is you have to deserve the respect. And one of the great ways in which people cheat about honor is they try to get the respect without doing the respect-worthy thing. So that's a problem. But look, without virtue signaling, we don't get one of the great positive forces of human social progress. When abolitionists, I mean British abolitionists, led by the Quakers, got going, one of the things they did was they identified as abolitionists and they identified as people who were on the right side of a debate, moral debate. And that sense of being part of a community of people who are on the right side is what drives a lot of social movement. And if you are on the right side, of course, a social movement can think it's on the right side and be wrong, as Crystal pointed out about National Socialism in Germany. But if you are on the right side, I think this sense of a community of people who are on the right side, who therefore have to signal to one another who we are. And as David said, you know, identity is central here. And sometimes the signaling is as much signaling about who we are as it is about signaling about the content. Good example of this, I think, in the United States where I live is the ways in which people talk about the Second Amendment, which says that you have the right to bear arms. A lot of people who don't want to bear arms, signal all the time that, as it were, they belong to that community. And a lot of people who do want to bear arms signal all the time they want to belong to that community. And that can get to the point where people are signaling what their view is about the Second Amendment without actually thinking about the Second Amendment, without actually thinking about what values are at stake. So I think that the preoccupation with reputation can very easily distract you from the substance of the thing that you're seeking reputation about, and that's bad. But on the other hand, as I say, once you've got going with a group that's trying to do something good, signaling that you are all trying to do that good thing is one of the things that holds it together. And in the book I wrote about on it, I focused on a bunch of cases like the rise of British abolitionism, like the end of foot binding in China, like the end of dueling in Britain, in all of which there was this shift that occurred and people started signaling their virtue by saying, I'm against dueling, I'm against slavery, I'm against foot binding, or whatever.
So we seem to have a lot of agreement such that, is it good to be, want to be seen to be good? It depends on the circumstance. We at least seem to all agree on that much. Let's start by getting into the fundamental ethical issue. So there's a strong strain in ethical philosophy. Kant, for instance, arguing that the goodwill is all that counts. It's not results. Certainly it's not your public displays. I think Antony started us off pretty well on that. David, do you want to kind of respond? Do you feel like morality should be a private affair?
Oh, no. I mean, I think, you know, like with all things, there's good. I mean, I think it's both Crystal and Antony were implying there's both sort of good virtue signaling and hypocritical virtue signaling, and perhaps kind of more complicated stuff in between. I mean, so in the UK context, you know, wearing a poppy, I mean, you know, most people at a certain time of year wear a poppy. I mean, that's a kind of virtue signaling. It suggests, you know, you spend a few bob on a poppy and the money goes to the good cause of looking after veterans. You know, round the corner from me, I live in Hampstead in North London, a lovely, affluent and pretty liberal area of London. And round the corner from me, somebody a few weeks ago, when the whole BLM thing was at its height, had a BLM poster in their window. And I remember kind of, you know, I walked by and I remember being sort of mildly irritated by it because, you know, they were, so, you know, most people in the street didn't have one. I didn't have one. And they seemed to be kind of, you know, laying claim to an extra virtue that we weren't expressing. So there can be something sort of divisive about it and almost kind of bullying about it in certain contexts. I remember walking by the house again the other day and seeing that the poster had come down and sort of thinking to myself, perhaps slightly facetiously, well, do they think that Black Lives Matter less now? I don't know. Yeah, I mean, it's messy.
I think you know, one problem is that, I mean, if a sign in the window is, as it were, just signaling, if that's all you're doing about it,
yeah,
then there's, I think, you know, that doesn't really add much to social progress. Though, again, there is this phenomenon, you know, which bumper stickers and slogans, whether they're on actual walls or virtual walls, can do, which is to say, you know, to offer a side to be on.
Yeah. And it gives people confidence, yeah.
Yeah. So it's, I mean, I don't know what the people inside that house were actually thinking. You know, maybe they were busy really doing lots of wonderful anti-racist things and reshaping their workplaces, and that would be terrific. If they're just putting up a sign, I think you want to say to them, aren't you on the edge of signaling virtue without actually practicing virtue? Mm. And isn't that a problem? But I don't think, you know, I don't think there's any harm in, I mean, just to go back to the Kant point, you know, Kant did think that, as he said, that the only undeservedly good thing is a good will. But A, Kant recognized that honor played a role in getting people to do the right thing. And he didn't think that doing the right thing didn't matter at all, right? He just thought that the only pure good thing, purely good thing, was trying to do good. And that, of course, only you know in the end whether you're trying to do good. In that sense, it's private. But it's not really private because the good that you're trying to do is public. And the good, you can't do the public good unless other people are doing it with you. All the big changes that we need to make are going to have to be done together. I you know, if it were up to me, right, I, you know, Black Lives would matter. but it isn't just up to me. It isn't just up to us. We've got to make movements to, and we've got to reform policing. You've got to do things. And if putting BLM signs in your window and then doing something is going to get other people to do it, or if it's going to, is it going to make people think, you know, this local politician said that they wanted to reform the way in which the police deal with people who are who have drug problems, for example, which is a big problem in the United States, that the police are given all these tasks which they're completely not trained to do. Well, that's someone who's seen a BLM sign and thinks, oh, wait a minute, somebody was talking about police reform, and I sort of agree that, you know, we shouldn't have a racially divided policing. And if this is part of doing something about that, well, I guess I'll be in favor of that. So I think it can sort of pull people in, but there is the risk that we've all identified of just...
I wanted to ask about this Kantian notion of the good, you know, having a, you know, a goodwill or good intentions, because, you know, as someone who is spending a lot of time these days and many days and for many years talking with people about racism and anti-racism, right, one of the great problems in our society is people thinking that it's their good intentions that protect them from any critique around racism. My intentions were good. I didn't mean anything by that. Or you know, of course, Black Lives Matter to me. But so that kind of belief that, you know, one's private or personal or you know, your own subjective intention matters more than the consequences of your actions, and that your private perception of your intentions, also that matters more than the perceptions of people who are harmed by racism, or other people that are harmed by racism, if you yourself are a Black person or person of color, because I don't think it's only white people who have to think about their complicity with systems of racial oppression. But I think that's a really, I think there are a lot of Kantians out in the streets.
Good. I mean, look, it seems to me that, you know, lots of things matter in moral life. It does matter what you're trying to do. And that's relevant to the question of, you know, whether we should blame you. But that isn't the only thing that's relevant to the question of whether we should blame you. Another thing is, were you taking care that what you were trying to do might plausibly be achieved by what you actually did? I mean, so you can be negligent. It's no defense if you run over a child. To say, well, I didn't mean to run over the child. If you were drunk driving, you shouldn't have been drunk driving, and you're to be held responsible, even though you didn't intend the harm you did. So I think, you know, in general, in moral life, yes, it matters what you're trying to do, but it also matters what you actually do. And if you're protecting yourself from recognizing the harm that is the consequence of these well-intentioned things you're doing by not thinking about it or by not listening when someone offers critique, then I think you can be blamed. We can be blamed for that. But in lots of contexts, I think that the right thing to say is the angel in the Book of Gold writing up there to decide whether St. Peter will let you in is keeping track of your intentions. But let's agree that what matters for us together in our social life is the effects of what we're doing. And let's try and understand those. And let's not worry too much about blaming people. Let's worry about changing what we do in ways that will make things better. And I think this is sort of somewhat stepping ahead of the conversation, but I think a lot of blaming, instead of pulling people into the right cause, pushes them away. And that's obviously, and that's an example of something that's exactly an instance, right, of intending the right result, but achieving the wrong one. And if you intend to get people on your side in anti-racist activities, but the effect of what you do is to drive them away, you should be criticized, not perhaps blamed. Maybe you have a blameless soul, but it should be pointed out to you that the object of the exercise is to get us all on board with making a racially just society. It's not making people feel bad about themselves.
But is there a problem? Because it's so much easier now to actually just do it. I mean, doing virtue signaling, partly, as we were saying earlier, for technological reasons, social media, Twitter, and so on, that it has corrupted it to some extent. You know, just quietly and humbly doing good is obviously the ideal, but we are invited now, and indeed encouraged, to perform. And I think that this does have corrupting political consequences in a way. I mean, if we live in a culture that encourages performative virtue signaling political activity that is to some extent autonomous of genuinely virtuous activity, I think it has all sorts of negative consequences. I mean, apart from anything else, it makes it harder for politicians to identify as insiders, which is absolutely crucial for coming to compromises. And, you know, if you spend all of your political energy divisively virtue signaling, it's much harder then to actually to manage conflict, which is after all what really politics is really all about. I mean, and if too much virtue signaling is disabling that process of managing conflict, then obviously, right, you know, that's dysfunctional.
That connects with the identity point again, right? Because you compromise, which is the stuff of politics, right, is about this political identity and that political identity having representatives get together and agree on something that neither of them thinks is the perfect solution, but at least it's better. Each of them thinks it's better than not agreeing at all, right? But in order to do that, I have to give up one of the, I may have to give up one of the key virtues that my group is tied to, identifies with. And so it looks like a betrayal, right? If I do that. And it's a very hard, as you're pointing out, David, it's a very hard thing for a politician to say, look, here's what I think is best, but here's the thing that we can actually do.
Yeah.
And let me be clear, this is what I think is best, but you know, I live in the real world. My job is to make things happen. It's not just to be correct, it's to make the correct thing happen. And I can't make the best thing happen, but I can sure as heck make things better than they are if I work with these other people that I disagree with about this. But now, I mean, that wasn't the most efficient way of saying that. But even if you said it in the most efficient possible way, a lot of people will feel alienated because they will say, well, why aren't you sticking to the thing that identifies us? We are the people who hold such and such a view. So I think identity comes in very much here, these political identities. I mean, I don't know much about the current state of things in Britain, but in this country, our political identities are now such that if you identify as a Democrat or as a Republican, it is really hard to stand up and say, look, this is our value as a Democrat, but I think we need to get to a compromise about this, so I'm willing to concede something.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that is very hard. And I think the kind of piling on that happens, two things happen very easily in the kind of Twitter sphere. One is piling on to someone who hasn't actually said what you're piling on to them for saying, right? That's one thing. But the other is, it's really hard to make a complicated thought. Twitter, by definition, limits you to uncomplicated thoughts because it has to be quick, though, of course, you can keep linking things together. But I think that means that, you have to be incredibly careful not to say anything that can be misinterpreted by people who are busy trying to hold you to the shibboleths of the tribe.
So given the soundbite character both of Twitter and just political discourse in general, you know, you can give a 3-hour speech and you'll get this much quoted out of it. How can we differentiate true compassion from virtue signaling, right? Both regarding individuals, regarding politicians. Crystal, do you want to start us on this topic?
How can we differentiate true compassion from virtue signaling?
Yes.
Well, first, I want to go back and thinking about this question. I want to go back to David's example of the Black Lives Matter sign and that person's window. And then David was sort of, you know, subjectively thinking or projecting what that person's intent was and, you know, what are they trying to signal? And I think that is a normal and ordinary thing to question. At the same time, in answering your question, Mark, I feel that in trying to distinguish between real compassion or even, you know, real ethical behavior in one's life and virtue signaling, that it's a question we have to mainly ask ourselves. I think that is what living an ethical life is about, not so much even the piling on of, you know, each other, but to sort of question ourselves and ask, you know, how and to what extent am I practicing my values not just in my private life, but also in my community in ways that might not be visible, you know, on social media or on Twitter. I think that the greater good can only be, I don't know if it can be attained, but it can only be aspirationally realized if that's something that we're integrating into our daily practice, to go back to what I was saying earlier, as a practice of reflexivity. So I think that is actually what is, you know, really essential to promoting the greater good. That is a capacity to focus mainly on ourselves, not in a individualist way, but to focus on how we're living in community with others in ways that we hope can be somewhat in alignment with our values, and also to allow for the learning process and for there to be sort of a an acknowledgement that our values are in flux and they change, and we hopefully are learning. Hopefully our moral education is something that we're committed to developing. I think that's also one of the great barriers to the greater good. That is this belief that I really get it. I really know what's right, right? That certainty that I know, my moral certitude is a great problem, right? We have to be open to learning and questioning and expanding our understanding of what is good and having a critical lens on that. You know, compassion for me personally is it's a spiritual practice. And by spiritual, I don't mean religious. I mean that it has to do with the unseen. It has to do with, you know, not only or even mainly the life of the mind, but like one's heart and developing a sense of empathy with others. So I think that can only really be done off of Twitter. I don't think that you can do that on Facebook or social media. I think that that is something that is part of your, it has to be integrated into your daily life as a personal practice.
But, I mean, I come back to this problem of pluralism. In a world of greater political transparency through things like Twitter and social media, we are, on the one hand, we're being invited to virtue signal, to kind of take sides in culture wars and identity politics and so on. On the other hand, you know, we're meant to also be celebrating the fact that the whole point of liberal societies is that we're allowed to believe in radically different things. We're allowed to have radically different moral goals. I'm obviously not in every area of life, but, you know, you can't have the sort of pro-murder group and the anti-murder group, but in many other areas. So these two things are though slightly pulling against each other, aren't they? I mean, the pluralism and the kind of requirement of transparency and in a sense moral consistency. You know, I mean, good virtue signaling is about moral consistency, isn't it? It's about how your surface behavior is consistent with your deeper inner behavior and actions. I'm not quite sure how we sort of deal with that.
I guess I think that, I know that's the standard way of thinking about what liberal societies are about, and I have some respect for it, but I think that the truth is, and that was, it was evident in your remark, David, about the anti-murder and pro-murder things. The truth is that we have to agree on more than just that we're going to be pluralists. You know, the classic version of liberalism that John Stuart Mill developed in On Liberty said that the range of freedom of action should be limited by the harm principle, by the principle that one of the things you're not allowed to do in any decent society, but certainly a liberal society, is harm other people. And then all the work has to go into having a discussion about what's harm. And that's a deeply difficult and controversial matter is, so just to take an example that comes from the world of our current world of dispute, how much is certain kind of speech so harmful to people that the general liberal tendency to feel that you should allow people to say more or less whatever they want has limits, right? Are there limits on hate speech? Is it really a terrible fact about Germany that they have a law that prohibits Nazi the defenses of Nazism. There are Americans who think, some of them in the law school with me at NYU, who think that, you know, our attachment to freedom of expression should be so central that we shouldn't think about banning any kind of speech at all. Now, there may be reasons for not allowing the state to ban speech, and I'm inclined to be on that side, but only because I think the state's likely to ban the wrong speech. That is, it's just going to ban criticism of the government if you allow it. It'll call it sedition, but it'll just so there may be reasons for this, but I don't think the idea, for example, that that words can't harm people, that's not a sensible idea. Words are very, very powerful, and they can harm people. That doesn't mean that we should shut people up. As I said, there may be reasons for not doing that. But so I think that, we're supposed to be talking about differentiating true compassion from virtue signaling. But my own view is that in political life, we shouldn't worry too much about what's going on in the souls of our politicians. We should worry about what they do. Mm-hmm. So I don't care whether the prime minister or the president responds well to a hurricane in Louisiana because it's in his heart, mm-hmm. or because it's good for his polling. I don't care. What I want him to do is to do the right thing in Louisiana. Now, in my view, the right thing to do is the compassionate thing. So if he is compassionate and intelligent, he will do the right thing. But, you know, as I say, in the end, what matters in politics is as much. There's a role in politics for saying things and symbolizing things. I don't mean to deny that. But at the heart of politics is getting stuff done. So in that sense, I don't really mind too much. If they're virtue signaling in a way that means they will be, that they're nailing a flag to a banner, to a post that they're going to be stuck with, whatever's going on in their heart, right? If they signal attachment to something, I don't care whether they're following it because it's in their heart. I want the flag up there to force them, the signal, to force them to do the right thing. And if the signal is the right signal, I'll support them. And I don't really care much about what's going on in their souls.
So can we talk explicitly about tolerance? Would less explicit moral judgment in the public sphere promote more tolerance? Is tolerance the goal, a goal that we should be shooting for? Is all the moralizing making it a less tolerant, less peaceful world? Can we maybe start with you, David, with this?
How do we reconcile a more value plural society, which undoubtedly we have now compared to even 50 years ago, let alone 100 years ago, value plural society with one that has a sort of sufficient basis of shared norms and virtues, if you like, that we can all happily signal away on and sort of feel we're being consistent about. The argument then just shifts to what's in the zone of pluralism and what's in the zone of the shared norms, doesn't it? And I guess, you know, tolerance is one of the things, the basic sort of mechanics of democracy and tolerance is a necessary condition of having political exchanges between people of different views and coming to some sort of conclusion, both in civil life and in the formal political sphere too. So those, tolerance is right up there in one of the kind of essential non-negotiable things, I think, in the zone of necessary common norms to just make the thing work. But I think there are lots of other issues that are very difficult to, and that perhaps partly what politics is about is deciding what's in the zone of pluralism where people can agree to disagree and society can, possibly with some difficulty live with those big disagreements, live with those big value divides, I mean, it's legitimate in some way for, evangelical Christian people to be anti-gay. And it's legitimate for gay people, obviously, to be pro-gay. And indeed for most liberal-minded people who are not gay to be pro-gay. But, these are, there are lots of areas like that where where conflict is necessarily inbuilt into any healthy liberal democratic society. And too much, you know, the greater ease of virtue signaling provided by modern social media, I think, has made a lot of these problems worse, not better.
Crystal, do you want to respond to that? I mean, is there, I guess, about the limits of tolerance, about tolerance as a, you know, do we need some intolerance to push social goals forward that presumably are shared, even if not explicitly acknowledged by 100% of the population?
So there are a few things that come to mind on this theme. The first is that I think we need to have a power analysis of tolerance. And everything I've heard so far is very much just sort of at the individual level. When I'm talking about a power analysis, I mean, if we take history seriously and sort of the historical context in which not only our moral values, but our cultural ideas have been constructed and, you know, that there's hegemony, that there's hegemony in which values and perspectives and ideas dominate in any given historical and cultural and social context. Then specifically, since my area is race and racism, if we take all that seriously, then we have to admit, for example, that people who are racialized as non-white, I'll speak mainly of the US context, that we are socialized to tolerate all kinds of things that are endemic to racism. So to tolerate, and when I say tolerate, I mean to take, to accept to some degree, to live with, to navigate. So one becomes habituated to tolerating and accepting different aspects of racial oppression, stigmatization, injustice, even the idea that, you know, sort of to riff off of some of what David's saying, what he was saying about, you know, that it's legitimate for certain people to be anti-gay. You know, when you live in a white supremacist or racialized society, such as ours, we become habituated to thinking that being anti-Black is legitimate, that it's treated often as just another opinion. It's the other side of the Black Lives Matter debate. You know, it's legitimate to think that Black lives don't matter. The reality is that for centuries, people have been morally educated to actually not only be anti-Black, but to be pro-murder, actually. I really disagree with the idea that there, you know, there's no, you know, sort of social recognition that it's okay to be pro-murder, because that's what a lot of racism is about. It's about either justifying, for example, indigenous genocide in the case of the United States, but also other countries that engage in settler colonialism. That's murder. So in any case, I think we have to have a power analysis of tolerance. And that also means if we're going to engage in, you know, helping to promote the greater good, and specifically like around issues of anti-racism, then we have to be honest that when we begin to address uncomfortable truths and uncomfortable realities, that people who benefit from systemic white supremacy, that they're going to have to consider historical legacies and ongoing realities that they're going to feel defensive about. And I think that defensiveness often is, and even in cases where we're not saying, anti-racists aren't saying you're a bad person for, you know, for whatever, your behavior, whatever, even just to bring up the issue of racism is sometimes interpreted as a personal attack, right? So you're saying I'm not a good person. So it's this defensiveness that can often be the barrier rather than the person making a moral judgment. Sometimes just bringing up race and racism is interpreted as a moral judgment of one's character. And that in and of itself is both a misperception, but also part of the social and political dynamics that reproduce racial oppression. So I'll stop there.
I think the question of toleration is sort of complicated because, etymologically, it has to do with bearing with something. So to tolerate something, you have to first of all think of it as somehow bad or wrong, and then you have to agree to accommodate it somehow. But so just take the anti-gay person. I mean, toleration in the sphere of speech, for example, allowing people to make Christian arguments against gay marriage, for example, is not the same as toleration in the sphere of action. We're not, you're allowed to make these Christian arguments. And if you are, if you're serious about them, and if you want them to be in the public sphere, you're going to have to listen to the Christian arguments against homophobia too. You're going to have to listen to the Christians who are on the other side and the non-Christians, the Jews and the Muslims and the atheists who are going to tell you different things. But we don't tolerate homophobic attacks, right? And in fact, of course, since I was raised a Christian, I should say that I doubt that any sensible person would think that a reasonable interpretation of the New Testament requires Christians, even those who think that gay marriage is wrong, physically to attack gay people. That's probably not going to be counted as a Christian position on any sensible view of what Christianity might entail. But so toleration, you know, it's about you're tolerating particular things. And I think we need a notion, and David was talking about this, we need a notion of the sort of what John Rawls, the philosopher, called reasonable conceptions of the good should be allowed to flourish. We should listen to each other and we should recognize that we disagree. And then there'll be an overlap in the reasonable conceptions good about things we all agree about. So we prefer democracy to tyranny, for example. You know, that's not one of the things that's up for serious debate, though I happen to think that if people want to argue for tyranny, it's so unlikely to be successful that I don't care about their being allowed to do it. I'll tolerate that. That means that the notion of toleration requires the idea, I think, of the intolerable, of the things that we come, this is David's point, really, we've got to have some common values, otherwise we can't run the ship of state together. And I think that one of the effects of a certain kind of polarizing discourse is to distort our perceptions here. Because if you sort of try and push people's ideologies and names and identities aside, and if you just ask them to think about what they really think about things, you know, most people are not against, are not in favor of, for example, even people who are quite racially prejudiced are not in favor of racial assault, right? Not many people defend lynching anymore. So there are lots of things where even if you say, well, we have to listen to racist speech, we have to tolerate racist speech, we have to tolerate homophobic speech, there are lots of things where we, I think, you know, what does tolerate mean? Right, it can mean not lock people up for doing something, but it doesn't mean that I have to say to someone who's homophobic, "Well, you have your opinion. I'm free. I'm free in my way to say, look, if you've got arguments for that, tell me what they are, and here's my arguments for the other side, and my toleration extends to being willing to discuss this." But again, it doesn't extend to allowing you to beat me up, since I happen to be a gay person. So I think, you know, we've got to think about the sort of the contours, as it were, of toleration, recognize that they're complicated, now on the particular issue that we're discussing. I mean, I think my own view is that talking to people who are quite homophobic, for example, but in a sort of patient way, is probably more effective than just telling them that they're homophobic. What you're saying is, if you say Christianity doesn't permit gay marriage, fine. So don't marry people in your church, gay people in your church. But the state is a different thing from the church, and gay marriage is a state institution, and it has to be something that works for, surely it should be something that works for most citizens. And even if you think that what homosexuals are doing in bed is wrong, they also have large areas of their lives which are not going on in bed. And in those areas of their lives, it's helpful for them to have the kind of security and protection that marriage provides for couples. And so you can be saying in your heart all the time, God, this person's a homophobic shit. But if you want to be effective, that won't work. I agree with that.
Thank you so much, Anthony, David, Crystal. Very enlightening.
Thanks for listening to this week's episode of Philosophy for Our Times. If you enjoyed today's episode, don't forget to like and subscribe on your platform of choice and visit ii.tv for hundreds more podcasts, videos, and articles from the world's leading thinkers.